Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have a guest with us today who many of you will know from his days on the state appellate courts here in Texas, Court of Appeals in Houston, and also the Texas Supreme Court, and lately of the United States District Court and the Southern District at Galveston. We have Judge Jeff Brown with us. Judge, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Would you tell our listeners a little about your background and where you went to school and the early stages of your career?
Sure. I grew up in the Dallas area, grew up in Garland. My dad was a Dallas police officer and did my undergraduate work at the University of Texas, got an English degree there, and met my wife, the woman who would become my wife, who was also an English major. We met in a Shakespeare class. And we got married right after we graduated. I went to move to Houston to go to the University of Houston for law school. And after finishing law school, clerked on the Texas Supreme Court, was hired by Jack Hightower, who was an elder statesman Democrat on the court. And such an elder statesman that he retired while I was clerking for him. Governor Bush at the time appointed Greg Abbott, who at that time was a young trial judge in Houston, to replace Judge Hightower. So I had kind of an elder statesman Democrat, and then the other half of my clerkship was with a rising star young Republican judge. It was a great year to clerk on the court. My buddy Todd Smith was clerking for Judge Gonzalez at the time. And from there, went to Baker Botts in Houston, where I practiced for a while before going on the bench.
One thing that's unique about you is you mentioned coming on the bench after Baker Botts. So you started off on the trial bench, as I recall, and then sometime later went up on the appellate bench. You were a judge on, as I mentioned at the beginning, on the, was it the 14th or the first court? I can't recall.
The 14th.
14th court. And then eventually went on to the Texas Supreme Court. So I'd love to hear some stories about your take on the differences between those courts and how the differences in advocacy and all of that.
Sure. The only other person who I know of for sure who served at all three of those posts and then as a U.S. district judge like I am now is another U of H law grad, Mike Schneider, who was on the trial bench in Harris County, then on the Court of Appeals in Houston, the Supreme Court. He was a federal district judge in Tyler. He's still around. He's retired from the bench. He's still around. And it's funny that you ask whether it was the 1st or the 14th. I've long said that there are only 18 people on the planet who know which judges are on the 1st and which are on the 14th. So those are 18 people. You know, it's been a great career. I had 6 years at the trial court, 6 years at the Court of Appeals, and 6 years on the Supreme Court, and all of them very different. All of them were pari appointments to begin with, but I had to run for election many times to keep those various seats. You know, I get asked a lot which one I like the best, and I don't know that there is one that I like the best. There were pros and cons to each one, parts of each one that I really enjoyed. And as I would move from one to the other, there were parts I missed about the one that I left behind. And that's one of the nice things about this gig is in many ways, it's kind of a lot of the best parts of those jobs all in one. I run my own court, which I did when I was a state court trial judge, and a lot of more exposure to the bar and to the public than appellate judges generally get. But I also get to federal district judges are expected to write. State district judges in Texas are not write opinions. And that's one of the things I liked about the appellate jobs was the writing. So I still get to write. And I have law clerks who help me do it. And the relationship with my law clerks has always been something that's very special to me, too. And so I still get to do that. It's kind of a nice combination of the best parts of all three of those jobs.
And your proximity to the beach has significantly improved from being in Austin or the 1910 courthouse.
That is correct. We live within easy walking distance of the beach. We walk on the seawall. My wife and I walk on the seawall every night. And then in the other direction is the courthouse, which is less than a mile from our house. So
great.
It's not a bad place to live.
I can only imagine. Well, you mentioned getting to write, and instantly, of course, I did think about the advantages that federal district judges have over our state district courts, which is having the law clerks there. Is your court, are y'all hiring what we would consider to be a law clerk or a briefing attorney in your chambers? Or is it all full-time permanent staff? Or how is your court handling that?
Well, the way I'm doing it, I have three single-year term law clerks. So every year I'm bringing in three new law clerks. And other judges are doing it a different way. Some of them do 2-year terms. Not very many of them do 2-year terms. And also we have an option of either a judicial assistant, secretary, and two clerks, or three clerks and no judicial assistant. And I went the three clerk route. So I have a case manager, a court reporter, and then three law clerks is my staff.
Oh, wow.
And some of the judges have hired permanent law clerks, but I have not done that. And at this point, don't anticipate. I like having the fresh blood every year.
Well, there's that. And then there's also your own experience having done a clerkship coming out of law school, which I'm kind of biased toward that myself. I hear the stories about permanent law clerks or career clerks, either in or staff attorneys in the state appellate courts here. And when it becomes clear to me that that's sort of an either or proposition, then I get kind of really sad because I'm thinking about all the young law lawyers coming straight out of school who won't get the benefit of that experience, which was so valuable to me as I began my career. And I think you'd agree with that. So I certainly respect you creating those three jobs for those newbie lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do agree with you, Todd, about that. And it was one of the real, I think I was one of the last justices on the 14th to still hire a term briefing attorney, a law clerk. And I understand why the folks who switched to permanent clerks have done it. The work never stops at the courts of appeals. They're opinion factories. And if the judges who have single year term clerks can easily fall behind the ones who have permanent staff attorneys when the fall rolls around and you're ramping up a new law clerk. So I understand why they did that. But like you, I think it's a real loss to, there were a lot more clerkships around when the intermediate courts of appeals were hiring law clerks each year. I don't know that there are very many at all anymore.
You know, when I was in law school, also a U of H Cougar, I clerked for Judge Wooldridge right down the hall from your chambers. And it was such a great experience just to get to sit in and see, day in, day out, what the court operates and how they make decisions. And I loved it. It's such a valuable experience when you're in law school or coming out of law school.
It really is. One reason I like to get new clerks each year is they come in so enthusiastic about that. It's all new to them and they're not jaded by years of practice or anything like that. It's all new and fun and exciting to them. And the older I get, the more I appreciate having young people around. It's a lot of fun.
Well, I was going to ask you, I recall when Judge Lee Yackel took the federal district bench here in Austin, and, he came, I think he had a short lag in between, but he had been on the Third Court of Appeals here in Austin. So he was doing, very similar work to what you were doing, and then went into the federal district bench, not quite the same path. And I remember very distinctly Judge Yackel talking about how the skill set involved advocacy in federal district courts is very similar to that of appellate lawyers in our state court practices, particularly the writing skill and the oral advocacy skill. And he actually sort of tried to recruit some of us, not directly, but he said, hey, you state court appellate lawyers really ought to come over here to federal district court more because we could use the kind of advocacy that you bring in the matters that are pending before our courts. Do you agree with what Judge Yackel said at that time? What would you add to it?
No, I do agree with that 100%. And it's the fact that we are expected to write reasoned opinions for so many of the decisions that we make. And as a state court trial judge, I was not expected to write those opinions. And whenever a judge has to write an opinion to justify the decisions that he or she makes, it's always great to have good briefs coming up from the lawyers who are in the case to help you. And also, I just as soon have the appellate lawyers, the really good appellate lawyers in there to begin with. They help me learn the law. They help my law clerks learn the law, help my law clerks learn how briefing is supposed to be done. And also, you know, it's the nightmare of every trial judge that the judge will issue an opinion, issue a decision based on some bad lawyering at the trial court level. And then the client parties go and hire really good appellate counsel and get the judge reversed. And the judge ends up looking like an idiot because he, and at least part of the reason will be because the judge didn't get the kind of briefing that maybe he should have gotten at the trial court level.
Do you find that it's fun to kind of put your fact-finding hat back on after so many years of not being able to do much with the facts and only really kind of operating in the law and the record?
Jody, it is. It is kind of fun to get to do that. In the time I've been on the bench, unfortunately, I've only had two trials. I've had one jury trial, which was a criminal case, and one bench trial, which was a civil case. And of course, you know, I was doing all the fact-finding in that case. I will say that in a way, I have discovered that juries have it a little easier. They just have to fill out a verdict form. I've got to write, you know, findings of fact and conclusions of law when I decide a bench trial. But even in just the more day-to-day matters that come up, I've got to make a lot of fact findings. And it's nice to get down in the weeds a little bit more than I did those 12 years when I was doing appellate work.
What do you miss about being an appellate judge, though, as opposed to being a trial judge now?
Well, from the Supreme Court specifically, I miss my colleagues and Todd, you know what a great family it is over at the Texas Supreme Court. And a lot of the folks who were there when you and I were law clerks a long time ago are still there. So I miss the court family a lot. At the Texas Supreme Court, you're dealing with cutting edge stuff. I mean, it's important to the jurisprudence of the state. That's how we get jurisdiction over it. And so I miss those big cases that we would work on at the Texas Supreme Court. And I'll tell you, it coming from the Court of Appeals, where we had to issue an opinion in a decision and an opinion in every case that came before us at the Supreme Court, we got to deny 90% of the stuff that came up. And I'm getting some cases here at the trial court again, where I would love to just say, petition for review denied.
Yeah, you're back in that same boat where you're compelled to decide the case in some fashion. You've got to dispose of it other than just
That's
saying,
right.
No.
That's right.
But there's, I suppose, one major, major advantage to having now accomplished an Article III appointment. You don't have to campaign anymore. And there'll never be another judicial campaign unless something really significant happens, I assume.
That's correct. And there better not be any more campaigns. I don't think Mrs. Brown will stand for any more campaigns. So I think that part of my life is over, which is fine with me. You know, coming from the Texas Supreme Court to this job, there were some people who asked me, you know, why do you want to make that move? There was one person who understood it completely from the very beginning when part of the steps that you take in the appointment and confirmation process is going up to Washington and meeting with two U.S. senators from Texas. I met with Senator Cruz and I met with him first, and then I met with Senator Cornyn on the same day. And when I was escorted into Cornyn's office, he said, "Now, Judge, explain this to me. You don't want to run for election anymore. You don't want to call people and raise money anymore. I just can't imagine that's true." And so he understood it perfectly, having lived it himself and still living it. He understood
it. Oh, bad.
And you just reminded me that, of course, Senator Cornyn was Justice Cornyn at the time that you and I were clerking. So that was quite a bunch that we had there at 201 West 14th Street. Back in the mid-90s, a future governor, a future U.S. senator, a future chief judge of the Fifth Circuit. Let's see. Gosh, there's a
future chief justice of the Texas Supreme Court.
Future chief justice of the Supreme. I mean, this was overall a bunch of underachievers, I would say. And present company included, I mean, compared to peers of mine that we've had on the show so far, we had Scott Field on as one of our early guests. You know, I joke around that I'm the slacker in the group because nobody calls me Your Honor.
Not at all. Not at all, Todd. Somebody in the group had to be the preeminent appellate lawyer, and you took that role. So,
well, that's nice of you to say. I think there might be some people that would disagree, including me, but I really have enjoyed following your career and Scott's career and the careers of those that I knew, because you're right. I mean, the court family is very special thing. And for those who don't know, I mean, the court generally there's a reunion of the justices and staff attorneys and former briefing attorneys, law clerks every year. And it's always so nice to have everybody come together and just, you know, relive old times. And it really is like just a very tight-knit group. And so we've been able to maintain lots of relationships that it would have been a lot harder to maintain, you know, outside of that environment over a long stretch of time. So for anybody listening who wants to apply to become a law clerk at the Supreme Court, I would certainly encourage you to do that, to be able to get into that fraternity. But then, you know, there's no slouch in the federal district or Fifth Circuit judiciary either when it comes to law clerks. I mean, those are highly sought after positions. And I know the folks that I know that have done federal clerkships, you know, they develop really close relationships with their judges. And it's very similar. It's a super tight-knit community. And they really say enough good things about it because it's done a lot for my career. But I'll never forget Justice Hightower retiring and then Judge Abbott coming in. And, well, he was super energetic and eager and very humble and, you know, just wanting to learn. And it was a very interesting time at the court for sure.
It was. It was fun to be there, kind of the ground floor when he came on board. And you remember, Todd, the building was far from ADA compliant, far from ready for a judge who uses a wheelchair to show up. And I remember the facilities folks frantically got the building ready for him to come in and did a good job of it. But he was such a cheerful guy to be around all the time. And I feel blessed to have gotten to work for him and Hightower both. They were very different judges to work for, but I wouldn't give back a day with either one.
I do remember that on the building issue. And I remember them blasting out the pink granite to build a ramp. And I may or may not have gone home with a few pieces of pink granite myself.
There may or may not be a few pieces of that pink granite up on my bookshelf at the courthouse right now.
There may or may not be some on the bookshelf right behind me right now.
I feel like the statute of limitations has probably run for both of you on that. I think you're probably safe.
Yeah. That was, it seemed like a historic moment. I remember at the time. And I know you're right. So, well, you mentioned the process of Senate confirmation in your talk with Judge Cornyn. Tell us a little bit about that experience, because that, from the outside looking in, looks like just an ordeal to have to go through. I mean, you're vetted in every possible way before you ever get there. And then that's kind of the final audition, I guess, right?
Well, yeah, I had been through three appointments at the state level, and actually more than that, you know, been considered for a couple, but I didn't yet. So I had been through the vetting process before. And this is not to say that the governor's office does not properly vet its judicial appointments, because it certainly does. But the federal process is even more of an exam. And it was a little bit of an ordeal. It was thousands and thousands of pages that I had to come up with and turn over to the Senate. There were interviews with DOJ, interviews with White House counsel, interviews with the two senators. With the first thing was with the senator's committee, which is running a gauntlet in itself. It's about 30 of the finest attorneys in Texas who are interviewing you all at one time. And then, you know, what, there were some groups that didn't like the fact that I'd been nominated, that said some really terrible things about me that my wife had to read. It wasn't very pleasant to go through. But we came out okay on the other end. And there was a 3-hour interview with my ABA person who was decide whether I was well qualified or not qualified. That was a long process. I was well qualified, thankfully. My hearing was 10 minutes long. I got a few softball questions from Ted Cruz, and that was it. So it kind of ended with a whimper, but I'm not complaining.
It's kind of like when your mood is worse than the actual oral argument.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I guess that's what you want it to be, right? You want the mood to be harder than the argument. And that's the way it turned out.
One of the things I've always kind of heard is that the appellate bench is a little bit isolated. You kind of find yourself cut off from the public, and you would think that in your new role, you probably wouldn't be as much, but your timing seems to be pretty impeccable, because now you're in the middle of all this coronavirus stuff. How's your court handling coronavirus and the restrictions? We know what the state courts are doing, but I don't know that either Todd or I know as much about how federal courts are handling it right now.
Well, it's being handled mostly on a district-by-district basis. We've had some phone conferences, and even our most recent one was a Zoom conference with all the judges from the Southern District. And so we decide, we make a lot of decisions on a district-wide level. We have, and then some of them we make on a more division level. And the Galveston Division ends up going along a lot with what the Houston Division does. We, in our two divisions, we're not calling any juries in until July 6th at the earliest. And that's been a date that we've pushed back once or twice. The two courthouses are closed to the public right now. So all of our hearings at this point are virtual, are either telephonic or on Zoom. And our courthouse here in Galveston won't be open until June 1st at the earliest. So each judge or each, once the courthouses are open, how quickly judges end up having people in their courtrooms will be made on a judge-by-judge basis. We don't get any orders down from the Supreme Court or from the administrative office of the U.S. courts in Washington. We are left to handle it on our own, which of course is fine with us.
Have you been doing remote hearings on for your court while this has been going on?
Yes. I have just started to use Zoom. I've used Zoom for a few hearings, but I've been doing telephonic hearings since I started back in September, and we continue to do that. It's the criminal cases where it gets a little dicier. We are able to do, we have to jump through some hoops to be able to do it, but we can do criminal hearings by video also. Civil hearings are no problem at all. And so aside from being able to actually put cases to trial, we've been able to keep up with our civil docket. And I've probably fallen a little bit behind on my criminal docket, but I feel like we can catch up pretty fast once we're able to open the courthouse.
You know, I imagine it's been interesting. You know, you were a civil district trial judge, and then you were on a court of appeals with general jurisdiction. You went back to a civil court, and then now you're back in a court that has general jurisdiction again. Did you kind of have to pick up criminal law and relearn it a little bit?
I have. Yeah, this is the first time, even when I was doing criminal law in the court of appeals, doing appellate criminal law and running a criminal trial court are two very different things. You know, and the biggest thing is, and this is something that even if I had had criminal jurisdiction as a state court trial judge, it would still be new to me in Texas, and that's sentencing. Federal judges, it's the biggest job that we have, the toughest job that we have. And I think that even federal district judges who had criminal jurisdiction in Texas state trial courts would agree with that, because in Texas, juries do most of the sentencing. So it's new to just about any federal judge in Texas. And it's a lot to learn. There's also been some federal law that I've had to, I haven't touched much federal law in the past 18 years. So there's been some federal law to pick up along the way too, but that's where those three law clerks come in. Very
good. A lot more admiralty cases than you probably had on the Texas Supreme Court.
I've got a fair number of maritime cases here in Galveston, as you would expect. And maritime stuff pops up more often than you might think at the Texas Supreme Court, and even when I was on the other two courts, but not near as much as here. And it's really the procedure is so different. So even when a maritime issue comes up in state court, you're still doing state court procedure. But maritime procedure, it's much more like a civil system than a common law system. So it's a lot to learn, a whole new vocabulary. If there's anything that I feel like I really need a lot of education on, it's maritime law. And I took maritime law and wrote a couple of maritime notes on law review when I was in law school. So I wasn't coming in completely blind, but there's a lot to learn.
The criminal cases are pretty different too than what you would have seen on the 14th court, with there being a lot more federal. It's federal jurisdiction, so you're dealing with probably a lot of drug offenses, you know, wiretapping, moving things across state lines, you know, things that might be criminal acts in the state of Texas, but whatever they have to do to be federalized, that's happening. And so I'd imagine that's a pretty different enterprise too.
It is. I've had to sign some wiretaps. We do a lot of drug. We have a lot of drug trafficking cases. We don't have any drug possession cases, but we do have a lot of drug trafficking cases. Child pornography is a huge part of criminal district. Federal criminal work. And in fact, that one jury trial that I've had was a child pornography trial. So that's some pretty unpleasant stuff. I had a couple of bank robbers who I sentenced have come through, and then a lot of illegal reentry by folks who committed felonies and then were deported and then came back into the United States. That's another common case that we see on our criminal docket.
Do you find the federal sentencing guidelines? I mean, I know there's some limit to discretion that those impose, and I don't know a ton about it because I don't do any criminal work myself, but have you been able to adjust to those and use those as literally a guide? Because I know that, you know, that's a big part of the sentencing process in federal court.
It is. It is. They're very complicated. There's a book that's 2.5 inches thick that has the guidelines in it. So far, I would say that they've been more helpful than onerous. As someone who has just started the sentence, it's been nice to have something to kind of give me some rails to stay between. And the probation folks are well-versed in the guidelines and do a great job of helping us out on that. My law clerks have learned a lot about them, as have I. And we can lean pretty heavily on the U.S. Attorney's Office in our district is awesome, and so is the Federal Public Defender. We get some really good criminal advocacy, and all of that comes together to make a very hard job as easy as it can be.
Well, one thing we wanted to be sure and ask you about was how the Camry of Justice was doing.
Well, the Camry
of Justice. I can't hold it together. That makes me laugh.
Yeah. The Camry of Justice is doing fine. I think it is perfectly happy to be retired from tweeting. It doesn't have to tweet anymore. No, that part of campaigning was fun. Not all of it was terrible. A lot of it was fun. And my alter ego, the Camry of Justice, was a fun part of my campaign shtick. It's not something that I miss too much.
I can only imagine. It seems to be the rule, basically. I don't know if it's a written rule or not, but once you take the oath as a federal judge of any kind, that pretty much does away with Twitter as far as the being able to actually post anything. And that's understandable. But I'll say on behalf of, you know, the Twitterverse, we kind of miss the Camry of Justice. Just like we miss Justice Willett and Judge Willett. It's sort of the same thing, but we understand. We're glad that you can come and be with us in this forum.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I am too. And I wish I could tell you that I missed being on Twitter, but it was kind of liberating to not have to deal with that platform anymore.
Well, I think with that, we're at time. And so we want to be respectful of your time. And we're just so grateful to you for spending this time with us today. It's good to get to see you and get to hear from you and kind of hear your thoughts on how this process has played out for you, and to know that things are okay down there in Galveston and you've adjusted nicely, it seems, to being on the federal district bench.
Well, I have certainly enjoyed it, and I appreciate Todd, you and Jody calling and inviting me to be on the podcast. I think the podcast is a great idea, and I hope it's going well for you, and hope we all get to see each other in person here real soon.
You know, we always like to leave our guests with maybe a tip or a war story, if you have one that you'd like to share here, just in closing.
You know, I think I'll make it a tip. It's a tip that I give to young lawyers mostly, but I think it goes for anybody, and this goes for trial court, court of appeals, wherever. When young lawyers ask me for advice on how they can be better lawyers, I always say to strive to be the most reasonable person in the room. You will endear yourself to whatever judge you're appearing in front of, and you'll do your client a lot of favors too. So always keep that in mind. Strive to be the most reasonable person.
I wish more people would hear and follow that advice, you know,
it's easier to hear it and give it than it is to follow it. That's
right. Yeah, it is. That's good advice, though.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on. And thanks to our listeners for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great, too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own, and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.